Hello. It's good to talk to you. Let's begin this week by thinking a little bit more about the effect of tech project number two. The exercise is to create a proxy browsing system based on an encrypted tunnel to a multi-user machine. I know all of that needs to be unpacked, so let's unpack it. When you learned to use the SSH client or a PuTTY-like terminal emulator with an SSH client in it, either way, you're using one of the fundamental mechanisms that grow out of our ability to encrypt, which we discussed 2 weeks ago. The primitive operation is that I can log in to a remote computer using an encrypted channel. SSH stands for Secure Shell, and that's an old style language incantation, meaning my ability to run on a remote system commands in a secure way. What's happening when you use that SSH client, either built into a terminal application or standing on its own, is that you're opening a tunnel of communication with a foreign computer, a remote computer, that is now going to be able to pass data back and forth to you based on some process that is running in the remote computer. The tunnel you have built is then turned into a browsing proxy. That is to say, when you use a browser located on your computer, which knows that it should proxy through the tunnel you have created, the remote computer becomes, from the point of view of the rest of the network, where you are browsing from. So you have a channel which is secret. No one else can see what is passing between you and the remote computer. And the remote computer is issuing requests to web servers around the web. Give me this, give me that. And as those responses are returned to it, it is putting those responses in the secure channel that comes back to your local computer. In other words, you have put up a screen between you and the rest of the net in which the remote computer, the proxy, is the screen. It does the browsing requests for you. It is seen by the rest of the web as being where those requests came from. And then it is passing the results back to you through a channel that nobody can read. What has happened under these circumstances is then multiplied in its value to your privacy by the fact that the computer you are using as a screen is also being used by many other people. Because it is a multi-user computer, all of your browsing requests, which seem to come from it, are mixed up with the browsing requests of other people. And so, without additional work, which will be done, and we'll talk about it in a moment, but without additional work, it's not possible for the computers with which your proxy is communicating to be absolutely certain whether the request came from you or one of the other users of that computer. The IP address, in other words, will have no effect in determining the particular stream of browsing going on, which means that real-time information, not only about where you are and what you're doing, but who you're doing it with, will be obscured. The consequence of building such a channel, which you learn to do in Tech Exercise 2, is that you have now acquired a much more secure form of web browsing than you've ever had before, and you haven't had to change anything. Where you are browsing from is now no longer possible to know. All your web requests, if you are logged in at QNX and using it as the proxy, all your web requests appear to come from a collection of multi-user computers on Columbia University's Morningside campus. As far as anybody knows, that's where you are. You're in the computing center of Columbia University. All the networks in between you and the proxy computer are seeing only fully encrypted communication. They can't be sure that it is web browsing. They can't have any idea what it is that you are doing because the packets are fully encrypted in that tunnel and all they can see is the external fact of the tunnel itself. You have opened a communication with a port on the QNX Prod 01 or 02 or 03 or 04 computer, and there you are passing data back and forth, and nobody can tell what it is. If you're sitting in a Starbucks, if you're using an overtly hostile Wi-Fi, it still won't matter. Somebody who can knock over your computer could get inside, and with not much more than the sophistication required to break into your computer, they could be reading this traffic in the same way that they could be reading the encrypted traffic from your WhatsApp messaging sessions. Nothing is ever more secure than your endpoint is. And if your endpoint is a mobile phone, then we have to allow for the fact that knocking over mobile phones is a thing that many good teams in the world can do. But provided that you have some reasonable security on the computer which you are using as your own, the local computer closest to you from which you built that tunnel, all of the intervening networks are certain not to know what happened, even though you were browsing the public web, and even though you may have been logged in at various platforms in the public web. They know where you are, what you are doing, and they know where you are coming from to the extent that they know that it's the Columbia University campus. But that's all that they can know. So just the one trick of learning to use an SSH proxy to browse with, and having a computer somewhere in the world that multiple people use where you can SSH to there and set up your own web proxy, just that much gives you an extraordinary set of advantages without having to change anything when it comes to the conduct of your life on the web. You're not anonymous. Where you are browsing from, the Columbia University campus certainly identifies you to some extent. And if you are logged in anywhere else, that web traffic can be used to keep track of your identity, but not your location. And you cannot be leaking that location or any other information to the intervening networks, because all they can see is your endpoint located wherever it is, the Starbucks on 124th Street and Broadway. All they can see is that your location is exchanging secret data with a computer at Columbia University, and that's all that they can know. So, this is the meaning of technical exercise number two. Once you have mastered it, you have taken back leverage in your life on the web. It's not complete, it's certainly not perfect, against a threat model that consists of active listening by capable national means of intelligence. It won't keep anything secret because they'll be inside your endpoint, your phone in particular. But with respect to almost everybody else, you will have created a workable screen that makes your privacy on the web substantially better. There are also a few consequences from the point of view of your life as a student in the university. There are a number of scholarly resources which are licensed to the Columbia University campus as a whole. And once you are proxy browsing through a computer at Columbia University, you can use those services wherever you are in the world, because wherever you are in the world, you appear to be browsing from a Columbia University address. This is true with respect, for example, to the Oxford English Dictionary and to the enormous collection of scholarly materials called JSTOR, and lots of other services, publications that are license to Columbia University through its library system, and which you can have access to through the library system website if you are located on the Columbia University campus, which when you are proxy browsing, you are. So there can be specific advantages to being browsing in or from, or apparently in or from, a particular location, and anywhere where there is a computer to which you can log in through SSH, you can shift your browsing stream there. Of course, the people who surveil web traffic will also still be able to attack your browser. One of the ways in which the platforms distinguish who you are is lost when your IP address is lost. But one of the primary ways in which the trackers of the world surveil your browsing depends upon the frailty of your browser itself. Big browsers, the kinds that you are likely to use, the Chromes and what have you of the world, big browsers run JavaScript inside the browser, a computer language meant to run inside a sandbox, so-called, so that your browser can be running code sent to it from abroad, but it's okay, you don't have to worry because that code couldn't really hurt you because it's run in a protected environment. This is a bad judgment in many different ways. The process of running code handed to you by other people is always dangerous, and that no computer should ever do it without careful thinking, which is not the way that computers mostly work nowadays, and JavaScript handed around over the web is one important form. What the tracker companies do is not to attempt to break through the JavaScript sandbox. They simply ask, by handing a little JavaScript to your browser, would you please run this code for us and send us all the configuration information about you, Mr. Browser, what your scheme of colors is and what your parameters are and how your tabs are set up. And the point is not that they want that particular information. The point is that if you ask a browser about 160 or 190 different configuration variables, it's likely that the particular browser's, quote, fingerprint, that is, precisely all the details about how it is configured and all the strings and all the registers, will be unique. Or if not unique, will be in one or another way so unlikely that only a small number of browsers in the world at any given moment would be configured that way, and yours is then distinguishable on the basis of other things known about you, like your network location. So browser fingerprinting is a way of getting your browser to squeal on you by giving enough information away that it is no longer likely that that information is duplicated by many other browsers. This is an attack which can be defeated, but you'd have to change things a little bit. For free, we get with proxy browsing a great deal of effective privacy. And if in addition we secure the browser against additional forms of attack, now the people who make browsers, the people who run advertising platform companies, they have gotten a little aware of the fact that consumers would like better privacy. And so what they want is to give better privacy to everybody who isn't the browser manufacturer. And whether you are Apple or you are Microsoft or you are Google and you have an advertising platform and you produce a browser, you will get increasingly sophisticated about blocking other people's tracking, but not your own. Apple, which doesn't officially run an advertising platform, only unofficially, if you like, that is to say, is only interested in surveilling its own cult members, Apple can be most aggressive about breaking third-party privacy invasion, but Google and Microsoft have also gotten, over time, increasingly aggressive about breaking third-party a privacy invasion, because to Microsoft and Google, each is the competitor of the bad third party. So each now increasingly running the same code base as Microsoft increasingly adopts the Edge into the Edge browser, Chrome code, open source code, free software being shared between competitors trying to kill one another. Please do keep in mind in this sense the importance of the open source form of free software, which allows competitors to close open code against one another while developing in common a common stock. The browser manufacturers will afford you some significant assistance against, for example, third-party cookies and other forms of misbehavior by websites that they don't themselves sponsor or control. And there will be, in their minds, also some benefit, up to a point, in allowing you to do yourself things which limit the effectiveness of browser fingerprinting. The only big browsers manufactured by people who don't run advertising structures and platforms, that is to say Firefox and Brave, will also do increasingly a good job of helping you to fight against browser fingerprinting. But a few affirmative changes in the Firefox browser, for example, if I can convince you that you should run the Firefox browser, which you should, a few more changes to the Firefox browser will provide you with a great deal of additional security and privacy, and we'll talk about that in a particular browser-limited technical exercise number 3 for Firefox users. The most important part of this for now, however, is that you have accomplished a great increase in privacy and security of browsing at no cost to your ordinary arrangements. Your phone's not changed, nobody told you to use a different browser yet, although I would love to. Nobody has interfered in any way with your use of the web, but you have gained very significant increases in privacy and security. The first thing, therefore, that Technical Exercise 2 teaches is that the implicit understanding that there are harsh trade-offs, that if you really wanted to have some privacy, you'd really have to inconvenience yourself, is wrong. It's not surprising that it's wrong. It's a story about technology that never made any sense. But unless you are a sophisticated critic of technology stories, that is to say, you work on technologies yourself that you can see are mythologized in a grossly inaccurate way, it's easy to believe in the story of the trade-offs, as it is comparatively easy for people around the world to believe that there is a deep trade-off between economic prosperity and environmental protection. A form of trade-off belief which is deeply ingrained in the political and public discourse of the very societies that need to be raising their game and the world's game on environmental protection without having to make the trade-off. Just as law school is a mythologization around here, wherever here is under the aegis of Columbia Law School, law school is a mythologization of the belief that you have to make a choice between doing well and doing good. You are public interest or you are private practice. A form of belief which is also nonsense in the detail of the lives of lawyers, that doing the problem right, working on the hard questions in an effective way, means learning how one can do well and do good. Learning how the trade-off can be instead the balance of a practice you have built. As it is the case, we can have environmental protection that is economically beneficial, as it is the case that you can have better privacy and security in the world of the net as it is without having to make trade-offs against convenience. And so the first lesson, which shouldn't need to be a lesson, is the demythologization of the set of implicit trade-offs that limit our ability to care about our privacy, apparently, while we care so much about what is apparently our convenience, and are misled, I have to say, I think, quite rudimentarily on both sides. The second important lesson is that when you control the flow of data yourself, when you are no longer the endpoint only, regardless of who is creating and who is consuming services, you have restored the possibility of significant user rights and significant user enforcement of those rights. By learning how to use GNU Privacy Guard to make your email secure and to provide industrial strength security for files and other forms of data in motion or at rest, you have restored rights to yourself of secrecy and of authentication, if not anonymity, the ability to sign in an affirmatively verifiable fashion without dependencies on third parties who can risk your security or your privacy. The ability to encrypt messaging and data at rest is the ability to enforce rights. Rights of privacy, rights of identity, rights of secrecy, rights, in some cases, of anonymity or at least of pseudonymity. Similarly, in this browsing exercise, by learning how to set up an encrypted tunnel to a proxy, one has learned how to restore one's rights as against, for example, national firewalls and other forms of perimeter censorship. Consider, if I am inside country A, where I have limited rights to the use services in the net, because nation A has a perimeter firewall designed to control the internet activity of people inside its territory. If I am inside such a country A and I have the ability to log in personally through SSH to computers located in countries B, C, and D, which is not hard to get, then I have a permanent personal fashion for climbing outside that firewall. I can log in using SSH to a computer in country B, C, or D, and then all of my browsing appears to occur in countries B, C, or D, and only the encrypted tunnel back to my computer in country A provides me with access to all those services in a fashion which the firewall of country A must either block entirely, thus preventing anybody from administering any computer outside country A from within country A, which is a big price for country A's intelligence services to be asked the society as a whole to pay. Or they must let it happen, in which case I have effectively escaped the firewall. I have not used a third-party VPN service. I have not routed my traffic through a circumvention location that country A's secret services are already busily blocking. I have instead used the general ability to conduct encrypted logins at other computers around the net, which is used by every systems administration professional in every country all the time, every moment. I have used that capacity to give myself a private browsing proxy anywhere in the world where people will give me login access. And I can get login access from universities and other such institutions through which I pass. I can buy login access on Unix computers around the world at very inexpensive prices every month. I can get friends to give me a login on their computers located anywhere where they control computers throughout the world. And then I am essentially able to escape from local containment structures in any territory in the world where I happen to be, where local containment structures are in place. All of this with one simple little Swiss Army knife of a tool, which you have now mastered or are about to master, and which affords you enough change in your relative power and rights in the net that it should give you an understanding that there is more that could be done, and that there are no technical structures which are so fundamentally at odds with your rights that you cannot find a way around them. And of course, I don't mean you personally have to find a way around them, because in the world of free software and in the world of our sharing, the problems that you have with the maintenance of your rights in the net are problems other people had too, and they have been, are doing, and will be doing the process of building the solutions for you so that you too can take advantage of them. Even Windows 10, I learned this week, now contains a native SSH client. I thank Jeremy for pointing this out. I don't myself keep good track of what it is that Windows computers do and don't do. But now we don't even need PuTTY anymore for Windows 10 computers, because the SSH client is just there for us, as indeed, of course, it should always have been. Microsoft never had any reason not to have an SSH client. But now, in the world of GitHub, it surely must have one. So we have on all our computers and in almost all our browsers, even Chrome, which hates proxy browsing with the passion that you would expect from the world's leading browser manufactured by the world's leading intelligence service, even Chrome will let you do this proxy browsing. And it's not just proxy browsing. The SSH tool will allow you to build encrypted tunnels for many other purposes, as in a course on security and privacy for lawyers, which someday might be offered somewhere, you would learn. All right, so much then about the technical exercise number two. And let us spend a little bit of time thinking about autonomy before we move on to the consideration of taboo. They are intimately related. As I was saying last week, it's important in understanding the autonomy aspect of privacy, which again let us define. Autonomy is the right, the power, the capability to make life decisions, small or large, without being affected by previous invasions of secrecy or anonymity. Autonomy, then, is why, where secrecy and anonymity are how. The process of concealment, whether of the content of a message or its endpoints, is merely tactical. It's a how to do a thing. The reasons for the how, the why of our privacy, is autonomy, the goal being to protect our ability to think about and learn about and understand and to make and effectuate decisions important to us in our lives without being affected by violations of our secrecy or anonymity. The point of autonomy, then, isn't to ascribe a particular degree of freedom as sufficient and call it autonomy, the ability to make one's life decisions in this, that, or the other way. Autonomy is still a defensive category. It's the ability for us to do what we mean to do without having suffered from invasions of secrecy or anonymity that affect our ability to decide. Freedom of expression is an autonomy proposition. We are free to decide what to say and how to say it, not only because we have legal protection against prior restraint, that is, at least in the United States under the First Amendment, nobody can order us not to speak before we open our mouths. And we are protected against retaliation after we speak, in certain contexts only. But in general, the government's power to punish speech depends upon something more, must depend compellingly upon something more than the content of what it was we said. But freedom of expression also implies that we are not blackmailed by what is known about us that violated our anonymity or secrecy, and that we are not so analyzed, so tightly tied to everything that we have ever said before, that we have effectively lost the ability to speak what is at the moment our truth. In that sense, then, freedom of expression depends, as an autonomy proposition, upon the freedom of thought that lies beneath it, which is both the freedom to keep our thoughts to ourselves, to prevent the violations of our secrecy, and the freedom to learn, that is to say, to read and to come to understanding anonymously, that is, to be free of the constant identification of everything with which we come in contact and from which we might, unfortunately, learn. These aspects of autonomy as defense against the consequences of invasion are crucial to its definition. They make it possible analytically to avoid a number of problems that otherwise arise when people start to claim as their autonomy right the forms of decision-making most convenient to themselves, where autonomy turns into what Isaiah Berlin would have called a positive right, and we are here providing still a negative rights definition of autonomy, that is, action which occurs free of the consequences of invasion and violation. That doesn't require us to determine what is the ideal scope of decision-making in society or to be broadening the power to decide. It is to preserve the power of decision against the consequences of invasion. All right, so under these circumstances, once we have grasped the way in which the definition of autonomy structures the scope and nature of the right, then we can begin again to think about this problem not as one of prediction or of control, but of influence. It isn't the case right now, anywhere, that it is possible to predict the fine-grained behavior of individuals consistently all the time, everywhere, any number of them. Which isn't to say that human beings aren't predictable. Quite the contrary. For example, human beings' locations are extremely predictable. Good data about this began to form itself even before the era of the smartphone, in the era of the mobile phone, when the question was only which cells of the mobile phone system you were in the course of the day. At the beginning of the 21st century, nice research conducted at MIT, among other places, showed that if you were present in more than one cell in the course of every 24-hour period, and if you were relatively active, that is to say, if during 12 hours out of the 24 there was at least one interaction between your phone and the tower, then it was possible to predict your location with enormous degrees of confidence, over 75% through the day. And this turned out to be a result that didn't depend upon how large the geographic range was of human beings. Human beings who spent half the week in New York and half the week in Los Angeles every week turned out to be as predictable in their locations based on the cell phone towers their phones interacted with during the day as people who never left their neighborhoods or who at least went from one cell to another. Where people sleep is overwhelmingly predictable. So it's not to say that the collection of information of the kind which is constantly going on through the spy satellite in your pocket won't predict your behavior in some respects. It will. And that predictability can be used, along with real-time location information, to make significant effects on your behavior. If For example, you eat at 3 o'clock in the afternoons most days. Then, if your smart-ass phone will tell people which corner you are standing on, it is possible for a Kentucky Fried Chicken to say 50 meters to your right at the next corner and will give you a special on the drink. And that will turn out to be quite effective in influencing your decisions about eating, of all things, fairly primal and important to human beings. But you know, because I don't need to explain, that the question of whether you are advertised to about that which you were almost always wanting, you almost already had decided, and then there was a reinforcing advertisement directly rammed into your consciousness by a notification through the smartest phone, you understand that this is the primary aim of the platforms for advertising. The primary goal of the platforms for advertising is to keep you sufficiently engaged through the network that the signaling provided by your engagement allows for effective short-term intervention in your decision-making. That's its goal. There are other possibilities long-term, an effort to advertise you into taking a mortgage on your home, and but mostly the goal is to use what has recently happened to reinforce impulses with respect to what is about to happen. And that process, from the point of view of the server structure, the parasite with the mind of God, the center of that metabolism, the purpose from that point of view is not to predict or to control, but simply to create enough effect to further engagement. It's just keeping you in the system. Control isn't important. It's not where the money comes from. Prediction is only important in the sense that the relationship between what you are doing now and what you might be doing in a moment is inferable, such that somebody might want to buy the opportunity to notify you, to conduct an interaction which pushes at you a little bit. Because a little bit of pushing would be sufficient to create enough effect, statistically speaking, to be profitable to the party buying the right to push. And from the point of view of the platform, all that matters is to keep you on it so that a series of such moment-to-moment auctions for the right to push at you will be pushing against an open door. Engagement is all that matters. In a world where engagement is all that matters, your autonomy has no value. Whether you are engaged or not has value. All other value flows from your engagement. Your autonomy, the private decision-making going on, has no value whatever to the system. And as a system, it will therefore operate to maximize what it cares about, and it will behave indifferently with respect to your ability to decide. This is not the only matter of importance with respect to this aspect of the divergence between autonomy and engagement. As I've said before, the machine, by which we now mean this the collection of technical structures, hardware, software, institutions, and habits, which constitutes the anatomy of the parasite with the mind of God, the machine is a behaviorist. By which I mean that the machine operates according to the theory of psychological structure created in the mid-20th century by B.F. Skinner and other primarily American psychologists. A structure which asserted that psychology is the process of studying the relationship between stimulus and response, systematically arrayed and understood, And that such a psychology which connects stimulus and response and creates both predictive and explanatory structures out of the pairing of stimulus and response, such a psychology is intellectually advantageous because it disposes of the one hard to grasp and slippery and ultimately unsatisfactory concept of psychology, which from the point of view of the behaviorists is the concept of mind. Psychology without mind is the promise of behaviorism. Counterintuitive to all of the human activities to understand human psychological life before this, whether located in the brain or in the Chinese medicine view of the world in the stomach, the view that there is mind had been before behaviorism the premise upon which psychology exists, the study of mind. If you can do it without mind, says behaviorism, if you can do it without mind, you could do it scientifically, because mind is the concept that has always tripped us up. The operationalization of this seemed to Skinner to be the subject of fiction. Walden 2, to be precise. The effort to understand how human communities would be built on the basis of behaviorist understanding, which didn't need to think about mind, but did constantly need to think about environment of stimulus and response. How to raise a community of human beings around a psychology which catered to the production through regulated stimuli of regulated responses. To one set of readers in the mid-20th century, Walden 2 was therefore a program for a perfected fascism. To another set of readers, it was merely a science fiction approach to an understanding of what it would be like to live in a behavioristically designed world, and everybody found, because Skinner was a far more talented scientist than he was a novelist, that it didn't seem like a very attractive place to be. But like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, the world of Walden 2 was an effort to think about the human future before the crisis of nuclear weapons turned all science fiction into a discussion of unintended consequences. And it's a workable discussion, not in the fiction of the 20th century, but in the fact of the 21st. Because, as I say, the machine is a behaviorist. The parasite with the mind of God doesn't require a concept of mind in the human sense at all. It collects trillions of stimulus and response pairs every moment, every day. It analyzes the correlations between those stimuli and responses. It applies the forms of pattern matching and pattern discovery that we call now machine learning, or even more non-specifically, artificial intelligence, to create analytic understandings, which are both about individuals, the patterns of stimulus and response. This is what you swipe on, this is what you don't swipe on. And the largest and emergent understandings, not of individuals, but of the species as a whole, or at least of 2.7 billion of them as a whole, or the ones living around the earthquake zone in Napa or whatever, right? That is to say, to build understandings of human communal behavior that are unavailable to the humans themselves, but which can be seen with the synoptic eye of the parasite. All of that activity, everything known by the parasite about the human race, is known on the basis of a principle that mind, individual mind, doesn't exist. It's not only that it doesn't matter, it's that there's no room in the ontology for it, because it's a concept rejected in favor of the correlation of stimulus and response. In other words, from the point of view of the parasite, Autonomy doesn't exist because the minds in which decisions are made don't exist. There's merely the dualistic structure of the stimuli that cause response and those which don't. A binary vision, swipe or don't swipe, left or right, up or down, click or don't click. And all that really matters is the patterns in that clickery. From a pragmatic point of view, if the parasite's a pragmatist, which indeed it is, from a pragmatic point of view, the form of mind in which decisions are made, net of invasions, it's all irrelevant. The system of engagement and the belief in human freedom, in other words, are intrinsically in conflict, not because the purpose is to exert perfect control. Not even the Chinese Communist Party wishes in that sense to exert perfect control. The idea of autonomy is in conflict with the system of engagement because the system of engagement is built on a conception of the purpose of human thought, which isn't about mind, it's only about behavior. And the world consists of a pattern of clicks and swipes and not the minds supposedly behind them. This implementation of a behaviorist understanding of the human race has now built itself out over the last decade in an extraordinary burst of cellular replication, such that the behaviorist parasite now controls, in the sense of engages, with a substantial fraction of every human's life. Even I, who refuse to engage with the parasite directly, who see no ads, who use no services produced as cellular exudations by the parasite, who uses no moments of time in connection with the platforms, whose mind is not to be found there, I am still modeled by the parasite. And that model still assumes that I am mindless in the sense that I regard myself as mindful. To the extent that I am exercising autonomy, I am doing so in a mind the parasite doesn't need to believe exists. But engagement there must be. Human communities, societies, whether of the oldest or the newest kind, whether the band of the last 5 million years, the tribes of the last 200,000, or the states and civilizations of the last 5,000, human communities do not measure themselves only by engagement. In fact, of course, given the omnivorous physical appetites and the immense curiosity of the human race, the ability to engage, to look at, to think about, to contemplate, to tinker with, to experiment over, that the human ability to engage is a groundwork pattern. The air that we breathe that we do not know is there. Human communities identify themselves with what they do not engage. Human communities identify themselves by what it is that one engages with if one is not us, not a human, not the people. Taboo, in other words, and I am, of course, expressing an idea as cliche to the anthropologist as a cliche could be, taboo is the process by which human communities identify themselves as autonomous, that in which we do not engage. That is done by those who aren't us. That is done by those who aren't really human. Like Ralph Barton's If You're Down in the Philippines, the lowlanders who eat fish let their daughters and their sons sleep under the same roof. It stinks.
We, if you know, who are real people, we don't do that. We eat no fish, and we separate the girls and the boys and make them sleep under different roofs. Below this is an incest taboo and a dietary taboo, and but the functional conceptions out of which it is built up exist for the purpose of identifying who we are through who we're not, what we don't eat, read, think, engage in, do. The restraints we put upon ourselves in order to indicate that we are of our type, our band, our tribe, our state, our civilization, our people. Like mind, therefore, taboo is a subject which raises for us a question in the world of the parasite and the species-wide nervous system of engagement. Once there is a species-wide nervous system, of course, taboo is difficult to maintain because the precise purpose of taboo is to indicate locality. We, as opposed to they, are the people who are clean and pure and don't do this or don't do that. We don't eat pork meat, we don't eat shellfish, etc., etc. The goal of taboo being local, it is inherently undermined one way or another by the process of the implied and ultimately effectual diversification that comes when you wire everybody up together. Those who do this but would never do that are now in direct communication with those for whom that is a thing that really needs to be done. But this, on the other hand, is what those other people do. And the consequence, of course, is a diversity of systems for the violation of taboo. It is certainly possible in a community of people keeping kosher, nonetheless, to spend an awful lot of time reading pork recipes and looking at pork pictures and et cetera. And we need not say that the question of dietary taboos is even more rooted in the physical reality of the flesh and the fowl and the birds of the air and the plants of the ground that one eats than are the sexual taboos, which are in every way capable of being dematerialized and reappearing as what the Greeks called pornography and we should now simply call everybody's wallpaper. The diversification of communication, the opening of geometries and pathways of mutual meeting and understanding, not to mention commerce and titillation, demonstrate, therefore, of course, the difficulty of the maintenance of taboo in the networked world. And for those of us who began, you know, a lifetime ago, it seems, or at any rate several decades, to try and elucidate the consequences for the human race of the technologies that we were building, this, the impossibility of taboo, the inevitability of information and ways of being and depictions and descriptions and solicitations undermining the processes of taboo. This was the first wave of understanding about what was happening. With respect to pornography, of course, a generation ago, it was already apparent that the human race's attitudes about sexuality were going to interbleed with one another, that all the various forms of structuring of the psychic life around sexual expression were going to be modified by everybody else's ways of doing it. That doesn't mean that everybody on Earth decided that Japanese tentacle porn was really good for them, but on the other hand, hentai versions of sexual expression became almost universally part of the experience of literate human beings. Is similarly, of course, the American Christian idea that magazines displaying naked persons could be kept out of the local convenience stores by coalitions of pastors sort of became a thing of the irrelevant past. Even regimes as deeply and long-term puritanical as the Chinese imperial version known as the rule of the Communist Party, which was as deeply committed to the regulation of pornographic expression over centuries as the French Ancien Régime discussed by Robert Darnton was in the 17th and 18th centuries, even that regime with its enormous historical value for control over sexual depiction has largely had to abandon the effort. And as one would expect, the fundamental forms of human engagement that taboo can only regulate uphill, more time and effort goes into the lifting of the forms of technical restraint to reinforce taboos around sex than anything else in the human orchestration. But in the last decade, as the system of engagement and the physical evolution of the parasite with the mind of God became the centerpiece of human economic and technical activity, as the system of engagement grows and we discover, of course, that the mere impossibility of taboo is only the first half of what occurs. The second half is that the parasite with the mind of God wishes to extirpate taboo. The system of engagement uses the violation of taboo very effectively. It wants to create engagement, and there is nothing quite as engaging as the mildly or maximally forbidden. This is, of course, why the curiosity of children and taboo are in tension in every village life, in every band and tribe and state and civilization since we became humans, or proto-humans. But the process of the regulation of children's curiosity against the onset of taboo is also a fundamental part of the human activity since the beginning. How we deal with children and their curiosity about the things, whatever they may be, that we do not permit, because that's what makes us us, is part of the process of what makes us us. Every Bildungsroman is about that. Every story of coming of age is a story about that, with respect to whatever it is that are the taboos of the tribe. Though you can see the fate of this when we bounce off the question, do children have a right to read? The traditional tension is maximized by the system of engagement that is the physiology of the parasite with the mind of God. The droplets of taboo breakage, which are used as pheromones to pull the attention back, the things that shock, the forms of electrification which give rise to polarity, whether political or social or religious or sexual, it doesn't matter. And of course, from the point of view of the behaviorist ethos that gave birth to the parasite with the mind of God, taboo is a phenomenon of mind, precisely a phenomenon of human mind, precisely a thing which the behaviorist structure of psychology of the parasite needs not accept. Because, of course, in a world where there is only stimulus and response, taboo stimuli produce excellent responses. As everybody, everywhere, really, actually knows. And this, that enmity between the structure of engagement and the meaning of taboo, is a form of human equality. If the purpose of taboo is to indicate that we are them, we are us and they are them, then the peculiar structure of the system of engagement is to move those polarities away from old taboos and towards new structures of engagement, stuff that riles you up. Of course, it is correct to say, as so many people have observed over the last four sad years, that the culture of the world we call Donald Trump, that noise in all our ears all the time, was a reflection of old taboo. The race barrier, the color line. And to an extent, impossible for those of us who grew up in the America of the civil rights era, to an extent that we could not only not deny, but were compelled to shout about, it was a violation of our effort to create taboo around the structures of racism and white supremacy that had been dominant in America. We were attempting to redefine ourselves as not like that. We are us. We are the people who overcame that. But what the parasite did wasn't either to deny that or to strengthen that. What the parasite did was to do both at the same time. Because from the parasite's point of view, it has nothing to do with whether we are the white people's nation or we are the melting pot democracy that fought the wars and marched the marches and suffered the fire hoses and the dogs in order to overcome that. We're just a bunch of stimulus and response. We told ourselves that it was Russian propaganda that had the property of pushing at every division and firing up both sides of every argument, but that was our conception of the parasite as a Russian invader, not a thing we had made ourselves and bonded our children to. In the end, what we discovered was that it wasn't the Russians, it was us, as it always was. Throughout the period in which we blamed things on the Russians, it was also us, and usually more us, because we had more with which to work. Moderation, a political system for restoring a patina of taboo to the undiminished flow of necessary engagement, moderation is the effort to pretend that we still believe in mind. We are mindful of the consequences of all this engagement because we employ a lot of people whom we don't think of very distinguishedly. Wage slaves in third world cities where wages are smaller than they would be in London or New York, and then in London and New York too, because you need them. But still, fundamentally, not the people your company thinks of as its brightest minds, are your moderators. Human beings whose minds are being used to wade through all the stuff that violates taboo and decide which of it should not be allowed, which tiny fraction of it should not be allowed. A vestigial example of mind forted up inside the bodies that are the parasite, pretending to be the mindfulness of the human race with respect to the flow of ugly stuff. But in the end, of course, the real hope of the companies is that all of this can be done by a fucking eye. That is to say that at the end of the day, the parasite can be used to understand the parameters of what it is that particular human beings would object to about its essence of engagement, and to moderate the flow of taboo, anti-taboo material through the net so as to produce the maximum of engagement with the minimum of commercially dangerous political pushback. That too should be capable of being understood in behaviorist terms. And so before our eyes, the mixture of the mind and the anti-mind approach to the problem of taboo demonstrates the way in which the purpose of the parasite is to break down some forms of fundamental human division in order to restore the more trivial forms of human division which create engagement, which nourish the parasite. I have no ambition to become a culture warrior, as I have no ambition to become a minion of the parasite. Those are the choices open in a world of Twitter engagement, but they are not the choices that would be made in a world of mind, as everybody perfectly well understands and as people are always lamenting these days as they move themselves from Vox to Substack or whatever it is that they need to do in order to make a living as opinionators in a world in which the purpose of opinion is the generation of behavior through engagement. The purpose of human thought is being changed. Thought, rather than being the internal nourishment of the mind, is the precursor to external measurable behavior. Thought is whatever mysterious spark of life it is that causes human beings to behave. From the point of view of almost the whole of the evolution of the human species, from, say, the 5 million years ago in which we split off from our chimpanzee cousins, to the 200,000 years ago in which we gained the power of articulate complex speech and made our bands into tribes, or from the point at which our tribes, having gained the ability to write, created states and developed structures of belief that we could call ideology, all is permanent, perfectly consistent with the low regard for the idea of the individual human mind, much less effective than the minds of deities, pharaohs, or gods. Effective, I mean, not only in the sense of not empowered to change the world, but also not empowered by systematic growth of knowledge to escape the narrow control of the priesthood who serves the god, who know the mathematics, who understand the movements of the stars. But in the last 500,000 years, there grew up around the most wealthy and physically mobile of the human race an idea of the importance of the individual human mind, a Christian soul seeking an individual pathway to salvation through the Word was one such form. But there were many others. And over the course of 500,000 years, within the structure we called civilization, grew up the idea of humanism, of the man as the measure of all things, of the human race, including eventually even its female people, as agents of their own destinies, in economies and religions and structures of social life and physical mobility in space and the ability to make and dissolve marriages and to conduct other forms of social relation on the basis of individual knowledge, choice, and will. Which implied government of the people, by the people, for the people, to some people who meant some people by it. But all of that hinges upon an understanding of the purpose of human thought, which, like taboo, is dissolving. In the solvent of engagement, in the desire of human beings for communion in the nervous system that they believe they built, and in relation to the parasite whose primary desire it is that they shouldn't know that it is there. Indeed, that they shouldn't need to keep the mind which would have known that it was there and acted against it. The purpose of human mental activity like mine is inflammatory. I am trying to increase knowledge of the parasite and to increase resistance to its operation. But as the parasite grows better at commensal life, its success depends upon the reduction of inflammation. Whether taboo or not, whether constitutive of a sense of some human beings as us, the inflammation continues to distinguish between us and the parasite, a physiological process that the physiology of the parasite wishes to control. And ultimately, if its genome is left unchanged, it will. Talk to you soon.